Number two. Early this month, on February 5, the entity Vice President Bush made himself conspicuous by a trip to Cape Canaveral, Florida. He was photographed with astronauts inside the European-built orbital science laboratory called Space Lab. According to official schedules, Space Lab will be put in orbit by Space Shuttle in late 1983, about a year and a half from now. Meanwhile, Bush announced that Space Shuttle Flight No. 3 is now scheduled for March 22, 1982. Supposedly, it's to last for a full week. For public consumption, NASA spokesmen are continuing to pretend that the shuttle is merely carrying out a leisurely series of test flights. We are told that the Space Shuttle program is basically a peaceful civilian program, in spite of the all-military crews flying the shuttle. But the peaceful image of the Space Shuttle program is a total lie. The fact is that the Space Shuttle flights now underway are part of a crash program by the United States to regain their military toehold in space. The United States has been virtually locked out of the military use of space by Russia since late 1977, as I have reported in detail in the past. Russia's domination of space for the past 4 years and more has been highlighted by numerous manned space flights. These have even included cosmonauts from 9 other countries besides Russia. Meanwhile, the United States went more than 5 years without admitting to any manned space flight attempts. The Russian long-duration space spectaculars in Earth orbit have been sufficient to build Russia's prestige in the public eye. But as I reported in the past, the Soviet space program involves far more than is being revealed publicly. Ever since mid-October 1977, the Moon has been a Russian outpost. There are 7 manned long-range particle beam installations on the near side and at least 1 base on the far side. In the past, I've reported that regular missions are flown to and from the Moon in order to resupply the bases and rotate crews. And slowly but surely, the Kremlin is inching its way toward breaking the news about its control of the Moon. Don't expect them to tell you everything, but they are beginning to drop hints about it. An example appears in the Russian publication circulated in the United States called Soviet Life for this month, February 1982. On page 33 of the magazine, there is a brief 1-page feature on space. Planted near the beginning of the article are the words, quote, "Today, spaceships shuttle between the Earth and the Moon with greater frequency than did the first voyages to the New World," unquote. At the top of the page, there's a nighttime photo of a moon ship ready to blast off from a Russian cosmodrome. Below is a picture of the Earth as seen from space. And in between is a statement in bold type, designed to give another hint about their moon flights. It says, quote, "From a distance of 70,000 kilometers above the Earth, the planet looks peaceful and even defenseless. The common goal is to protect our blue and green home," unquote. My friends, satellites are not used at altitudes of 70,000 kilometers. The highest orbit that is generally useful for Earth satellites is the geosynchronous orbit for stationary satellites over the equator. 70,000 kilometers is almost twice that far from the Earth. The only time when a spacecraft reaches that far from the Earth is when it is on its way to or from the Moon or another planet. Russia's interest in space also extends far beyond military factors. In audio letter 38, I describe the plans of Russia's new rulers for the colonization of our solar system. Those plans are moving ahead steadily. In fact, at this very moment, not one but 2 Russian spacecraft are approaching the planet Venus. They are said to be unmanned, but, my friends, they are manned spacecraft. In audio letter 38, I reported that the Russians had settled on Venus, not Mars, as the first target beyond the Moon for experimental colonization. They first started landing unmanned craft on Venus some 7 years ago, and they have learned some key facts not yet known in the West. 4 years ago, the Russians began a series of increasingly long-durationed manned orbital space flights, which were widely publicized. These were gradually extended to 6 months and more to learn how well crews would stand up to interplanetary space travel. Early last fall, these long-duration orbital flights were completed. The Russians had learned everything they needed to know. Last October 30 and November 4, 1981, two Russian spaceships blasted off for Venus. Both ships are manned by Russian cosmonauts, and both are preparing to land on Venus as I say these words. My friends, the comparison between the space programs of the United States and Russia today is a study in tragic ironies. We Americans are being told that the space shuttle is primarily a civilian-oriented project, but it is actually military. We're being told that it is the world's first reusable spacecraft, but a shuttle is actually being lost on every flight. We're being told that the space shuttle has put us years ahead of Russia, but we have actually slipped years behind. We're often told that our rulers want only peaceful activities in space, but they are shutting down almost the entire civilian scientific space program. Funding is continuing for one or two peaceful projects which are too visible to cancel without an uproar, such as the Space Telescope. The follow-on projects to explore our solar system are being lopped off and discarded because they contribute nothing to our leaders' plans for war. We're told constantly that the Russians have nothing but war and conquest on their minds. But it is the Russians, not we Americans, who at this moment have two teams of spacemen preparing to land on Venus. They're going there for reasons which have nothing to do with war. The Russians are exploring the solar system simply because it is there. Russia's new rulers believe that it is man's destiny to move into space. The urge to explore that motivated their Viking ancestors of old is alive and well today in the Russian space program. My friends, I believe that same spirit is still strong also among the American people today. Why else would our leaders have to keep selling the space program to us as a great adventure? But the Bolsheviks here who now control America's space program do not care about adventure or exploring the unknown or inspiring the human spirit. They care only about power, control, intrigue, revolution, and war. And their plans for war are shaping America's space shuttle program. 12 days ago, on February 16, the space shuttle was moved out to the launch pad at Cape Canaveral, 5 days ahead of schedule. This will be America's third space shuttle launch, and it is also the third shuttle that is being used. The first shuttle, the Real Columbia, was destroyed last April, as I detailed in Audio Letter 64. It was replaced by the training shuttle Enterprise, which landed at Edwards Air Force Base and was taken to Florida. The Enterprise flight last November was a stopgap measure, while a third shuttle could be extensively modified. The new shuttle now at Cape Canaveral is one of the three secret shuttles from White Sands that I mentioned in Audio Letter 63 last spring. It has undergone extensive modifications since the first space shuttle disaster 10 months ago in April 1981. It still looks the same as the original Columbia, at least from a distance, but this shuttle is actually far, far different. The shuttle now on the pad, my friends, is armed to the teeth. The basic mission of this third shuttle is the same as that of the first shuttle, nearly a year ago. 1 year ago today, in Audio Letter 62, I described in detail what the space shuttle was supposed to do. Its payload was a heavily armored, laser-firing robot battle station designed for space reconnaissance over Russia. Russian space weapons finished destroying all of America's spy satellites nearly 4 years ago. That means America's war planners will be shooting almost blind at Russia if they start a war without somehow acquiring new reconnaissance data. The space shuttle is trying to solve that problem by getting the new hardened satellite into orbit. That is what the space shuttle flights right now are all about, attempts at reconnaissance. After each shuttle takes off from Florida, it follows a long, swooping, curved launch into the north in order to fly over Russia. The American Bolshevik military planners here believe that if they can once get their new super spy satellite into orbit, it will do the job. They are confident that it can survive any attacks by Russian space weapons long enough to radio back a large amount of reconnaissance data. And once they have that, the Pentagon will be ready to take America to war. Last spring, the Columbia was destroyed before the spy satellite could be deployed. Likewise, the makeshift Enterprise mission in November was a failure. But the military shuttle planners believe it will be a different story with their shuttle number 3 now preparing for launch. In the cargo bay of this shuttle, there is a new robot reconnaissance battle station like the one I described in Audio Letter 62. There is also an additional laser mounted in the forward end of the cargo bay just behind the crew compartment. It is a hydrogen fluoride gas dynamic laser mounted vertically, aimed upward. It is equipped with a swiveling head consisting of mirrors that can aim the beam around a wide range of angles. The hydrogen fluoride laser in the cargo bay is intended mainly to protect the shuttle while it climbs toward orbit. As I reported in Audio Letter 64 last spring, the Columbia came under fire shortly before it reached orbit. Intelligence analysts here eventually obtained enough information about what happened to decide on installing the cargo bay laser. As the shuttle climbs, the air will go thinner and thinner, dwindling to almost nothing long before the rocket engines shut off. At the earliest possible moment, the modified cargo bay doors, which have no hinges on this shuttle, will be blown off by special explosive devices. As the cargo bay doors flutter away from the shuttle, it will leave the upper half of the bay wide open. The cargo bay laser will be ready to fire from that moment onward. It's equipped with the same system called SEER that I described in Topic number 1. Since a laser equipped this way successfully shot down a cosmosphere last month, the shuttle planners believe the shuttle will reach orbit safely. Once in orbit, planners here believe that the main threat to the shuttle will be Russia's orbiting Cosmos interceptors. These manned killer satellites are responsible for sweeping the skies clear of American spy satellites. In order to deal with that threat, there have been truly radical modifications to the shuttle. Whenever the space shuttle is discussed, it's always emphasized that shuttle astronauts can work in their shirt sleeves. No need for space suits, because riding in a shuttle is almost like riding in an airliner. Not so this time, my friends. When Colonel Jack Lousma and Colonel C. Gordon Fullerton lift off in this shuttle, they will be in space suits. What's more, they will be depending on their space suits because their crew cabin will not be pressurized. The whole lower front portion of their ship, below the flight deck, has been turned into a weapons bay. As soon as the shuttle reaches orbit, the nose will open up to the vacuum of space. The nose will fold downward and back, somewhat like certain cargo aircraft whose noses fold upward to load and unload. As soon as the nose opens up, a complex laser system will emerge. The system has 5 tubular sections aimed up, down, to each side, and straight ahead. Each laser tube has a swiveling mirror head for beam aiming, like that of the cargo bay laser I mentioned earlier. Once deployed, the nose laser system will be able to fire in almost any direction. The only exception is a narrow corridor to the rear of the shuttle. The nose laser system is described as a nuclear-pumped helium plasma laser with 5 resonators. The nuclear power pack can fire any one of the 5 laser tubes at a time. It's not as powerful as the cargo bay laser. But unlike the cargo bay laser, the nose laser system can operate for a long time on an intermittent basis. And the shuttle planners believe it will be powerful enough to disable the manned Russian killer satellites. Under the protection of the nose laser system, Lousma and Fullerton are to deploy the robot spy satellite. As soon as it is deployed, they are to return to Earth in a small Gemini-type re-entry capsule. This part of the plan is the same as I revealed a year ago for the first shuttle flight. Meanwhile, the shuttle will remain in orbit. The nose laser system is programmed to keep right on zapping any Russian Cosmos interceptors that come within range. It will continue doing so until it is destroyed or the nuclear laser runs down, which could be a very long time. It will constitute a very dangerous nuisance in space, and the Russians will have little choice but to destroy it. The American Bolsheviks here hope the Russians will lose a lot of spaceships and men before they succeed in doing so. If the military shuttle planners are right in their calculations, the third space shuttle mission could turn into a battle royal in space. If they are wrong, they presently plan to try again one more time. As of now, the fourth space shuttle mission is scheduled for the 4th of July. After that, no matter what happens with the space shuttle, they are now planning to go ahead anyway in setting off Nuclear War I. Because, my friends, the American Bolsheviks here have scored an intelligence coup against Russia. Topic number 3. For nearly a year now, I've been reporting on the grand strategy of the American Bolsheviks and their Zionist partners to set off nuclear war. Their basic plan is an updated version of the one that was successful in setting off World War I. The prelude to that war involved ever-widening uncontrollable crises in the Balkans. Likewise today, the whole world is being balkanized by means of Bolshevik Zionist intrigues. Last year, I began warning that we would soon be seeing more and more simultaneous crises in the world as the fever for war rises. Today, these simultaneous crises are now upon us, right on schedule. El Salvador and the rest of Central America are aflame with internal upheaval. Poland is under martial law. While America tries to transform Poland's troubles into a complete bloody disaster. In the Middle East, not one but several time bombs are almost ready to go off since spring is coming. These are the things I was talking about in my advance reports last year. The Reagan-Begin axes of Bolsheviks and Zionists intend to manipulate these crises, and more to come to pave the way for war. Suddenly, certain crises will combine to trigger a chain of events leading to Nuclear War I. The joint military junta of the United States Pentagon and Israel are working on a fast timetable for all of this. As I reported in past tapes, they are aiming for mid-summer 1982, this year, for the final war sequence to begin. This will involve regional conflicts in the Middle East and elsewhere, which gradually escalate to engulf the superpowers. The whole thing is being set up to make nuclear war appear unavoidable. At last, all-out nuclear war itself will break out between the United States and Russia. It will be made to appear accidental. But as I have detailed in the past, my friends, Nuclear War I will actually begin with an American nuclear first strike against Russia. Up to now, the secret war planners here have been expecting that it would take many months for the final war buildup to run its course. For example, a Mideast war might be triggered this summer of 1982, but it could take until the spring of 1983 for the resulting nuclear war to erupt. That has been their thinking until very recently. But a drastic change is now taking place in the secret war planning underway here in America. The timetable for Nuclear War I has now been speeded up by many months. My friends, as of now, the new target date for an American nuclear surprise attack on Russia is mid-September 1982. That is little more than 6 months from now. The reason for this drastic shortening of the war timetable is a major intelligence coup which has been scored by the American Bolsheviks here. Two high-ranking Soviet generals have recently been spirited out of Russia and brought here to Washington. These two men are Bolsheviks whom Russia's new non-Bolshevik rulers failed to detect and weed out. In intelligence parlance, they remained as moles in Russia's military apparatus. Now they have been brought to America, and they bring with them a wealth of data about Russia's current military posture. Thanks to these two former Bolshevik Soviet generals, the secret war planners here now have enough information to plan a nuclear strike against Russia. If they can refine that information from data from Space Shuttle Flights Numbers 3 and 4, so much the better. But if neither of the next two shuttle flights is successful, the war planners intend to wait no longer. They want to make use of the intelligence obtained from the two Soviet generals while it is still fresh. And so the secret war planners here have now set a deadline for themselves of mid-September 1982 to attack Russia. As it stands now, my friends, Nuclear War One could erupt at any time after Space Shuttle Flight Number 4 this summer and well before the end of September. My friends, I am telling you these things not to panic you, but for the opposite reason. I want you to be able to understand events for yourselves so that you can take action to protect yourselves and your families. I cannot emphasize strongly enough that what I am reporting to you are the plans of men. If you see certain things happening, you will know that these war plans are succeeding and that war is imminent. If you do not see certain parts of the plan happening in the news, then you will know that the war plans may have hit a snag of some kind. In that regard, I also want to let you know about the biggest of all possible snags that may soon trip up the American Bolsheviks here. For some time now, I've been reporting on the hidden struggle for power that is dividing the United States government. On one side are the American Bolsheviks, whose chief government operative today is Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger. On the other side is the Rockefeller Cartel, whose chief governmental spokesman is Secretary of the State Alexander Haig. Weinberger and Haig are constantly at each other's throats in the news. This is only a pale shadow of their intrigues behind closed doors. Caught in the middle is the puppet entity, President Reagan. Our puppet president was installed by the Rockefeller Cartel, but has been largely under Bolshevik control ever since the assassination attempt last March. Like a marionette, he dances according to whatever strings are being pulled at the moment by either side. As of now, America's military is dominated by the Bolsheviks here, but that was not always so. The Rockefeller Cartel has been regaining power and is now preparing to try to regain control over the military here. As long ago as 1963, Rockefeller insiders set up a contingency plan for an eventual military coup d'etat against a puppetized president. I revealed the existence of the plan 5 years ago this month in Audio Letter 21. Early stages of the plan were actually set in motion against then-President Carter, but events later that year caused the plan to be aborted. Now the plan for a Rockefeller Cartel-backed military coup is being set in motion again, and this time it is a crash program, intended to be carried out within a matter of months. As I detailed in Audio Letter 67, the Rockefeller Cartel cannot afford to let their Bolshevik enemies here succeed in setting off nuclear war. Therefore, the military coup d'etat must take place before the American Bolshevik surprise attack against Russia. If possible, the coup will be carried out before the fourth space shuttle flight this summer, because war will be possible any time after that. The man who is in charge of the military coup preparations is a 4-star Army general. That is unusual because coups are usually carried out by lower-ranked officers. But this time, the circumstances are very unusual, too. The general in charge of the coup to come, my friends, is General Alexander Haig, presently Secretary of State. He is looking forward to the day when he can really say, quote, "I am in charge here," unquote. Lately, Haig has been on major TV programs almost daily. He has also been traveling almost continuously to help pave the way for the coup d'etat to be accepted abroad. Most importantly, the Russians were informed of the impending coup during the Haig-Gromyko talks last month. Part of the new quid pro quo between the Rockefeller cartel and the Kremlin has to do with the coup being planned here. The Rockefeller group were afraid that the Kremlin would interpret a military coup as a sign that an attack on Russia would follow quickly. Haig has assured the Russians that this will be an anti-Bolshevik coup and that the Bolshevik war plans will be terminated. Gromyko was very dubious in his talks with Haig. He expressed fears that the whole plan will backfire and cause the American Bolsheviks in the Pentagon to push the button. But Haig finally extracted an agreement that the Russians will not interfere with the coup, nor use the opportunity to attack the United States. What is brewing now, my friends, is really a counter-coup. 3 years ago, the Rockefeller cartel lost its power over the United States government in a Bolshevik coup d'etat. I detailed those events at the time, but otherwise it was generally hidden from public view. Now the Rockefeller cartel is trying to take back the power they lost 3 years ago. If the military takeover does take place, it too is likely to be largely hidden in its details from public view. Only one event in the plan is likely to be visible to all. That event, my friends, will be the sudden death of the entity known as President Ronald Reagan. If that happens by the end of summer 1982, no matter what the official story may be, you will know that the military coup d'etat has taken place. On the other hand, should something happen to Secretary of State Haig by that time, it could well mean that the Bolsheviks have foiled the coup. It is all a race against time, my friends, and the stakes in this race involve nothing less than the very survival of our United States. Now it's time for my last-minute summary. In this audio letter, I've had no choice but to dwell on the subject of approaching war, nuclear war. Nuclear war fever is conditioning us for war, and hostilities are escalating in the secret war already underway. While 2 manned Russian spacecraft are approaching Venus, America's space program has dwindled to a last-ditch military stab at space. The war timetable is being speeded up, with nothing in sight but a military coup d'etat to stop it. The situation we face today, my friends, reminds me of a course in military justice which I took in law school in 1950. It was taught by an Army general. He started the first class with a statement that is still ringing in my ears today. He said, "If you remember nothing else from this course, make no mistake about one thing. The United States of America was born in war, and the United States will die in war." Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you. And may God bless each and every one of you.